tonight on Arena. Dermot Dunn and Martin Tursch with Bach's Goldberg Variations for Two Accordions, and Eric and Camden are among the TV reviews this evening. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. And we start tonight with our weekly TV reviews. Two brand new shows for you. Firstly, up the highly anticipated Netflix series, Eric, starring Gabby Hoffman and Oscar nominee Benedict Cumberbatch, created and written by Emmy winner Abby Morgan, who also wrote the likes of The Hour, Shame and The Iron Lady. In this series, Cumberbatch plays the character of Vincent, a troubled puppeteer who is grieving for his missing 9-year-old son and finds solace in Eric, the monster under the bed type of walking puppet, I suppose we could call Eric. And also we have Camden, a 4-part documentary series on Disney Plus, produced by none other than the superstar Dua Lipa. The series tells the story of how Camden Town in London became the beating heart of music and influenced the lives and careers of some of the most iconic of artists. The series has no shortage of appearances, everyone from Coldplay's Chris Martin, Noel Gallagher, Pete Doherty, Mark Ronson, Nile Rodgers, Boy George and Suggs from Madness. With me in studio this evening, Chris Wasser and Arlene Hunt, who are here to review the two series for us. And we'll start with Eric. Written here by Abby Morgan, Shame, The Iron Lady, The Hour. That's quite a pedigree that she's coming from. And then you look at the cast. What's the story?
It's a big one. It's set in New York in 1985, and it follows this genius but volatile puppeteer by the name of Vincent Anderson, portrayed by Benedict Cumberbatch. And as I said, he's the creator. He is a bit of a genius, or at least he used to be. He's the creator of this Sesame Street slash Mr. Rogers type show called Good Day Sunshine, which seems to be one of the most popular shows on American television for children. But the ratings are starting to fall down. So he's in trouble and he's under pressure to kind of create a new puppet. But we see in the opening scenes that, you know, he does work with his friends, or at least they used to be his friends, but they've started to kind of, you know, they can barely tolerate him these days. He's quite mean towards the people he works with. He drinks a little bit too much. You know, it's either his ideas or nobody else's. And then at home too, things are a little bit rough. His son, his 9-year-old son, Edgar, he's trying to show him new ideas for a puppet, but he's not listening to him. It's just, it has to be his own ideas. And his relationship with his wife, played by Gabby Hoffman, that's quite fractious too. They're always arguing, their arguments have turned nasty. So it's no surprise then when the following day, after a particularly bad argument between the mother and the father, Edgar, who Vincent was supposed to accompany to school, he goes missing. He doesn't return home from school.
And so that's where we start off. You've been quite nice to him. He's horrible, he's controlling, he's manipulative. I'm talking about the Benedict Cumberbatch character here. He's controlling.
He's in a love-hate relationship with everyone.
With himself,
I would. He's particularly hard on himself, and he's got a very contentious relationship with his father, who's like a property magnate in New York City. And, you know, without going too far into the plot, there is serious animosity between father and son, and son and father. It's all very complex.
Intergenerational type of thing is going on.
I think his father is portrayed as a man of doing. And, you know, you're not sure that he necessarily approves of his puppet, even though he was quite successful for a very long time.
As the puppeteer,
he did a number one show, but then it's 1985, times have changed. He wants his puppets to be a certain way. And then
quite a traditionalist, in fact,
but
isn't
he? Management now are talking about, like, bringing a beatbox puppet, you know, a little breakdancing puppet, you know, move with the times.
It's the equivalent of somebody saying in today's parlance, I suppose, would be, can you do this half-hour puppet show as a TikTok film for 10 seconds. That's type of innovation that he cannot countenance it at all.
No, every episode of Good Day Sunshine, even the theme tune
is the name of the puppet show.
It's supposed to be like Sesame Street. You know, there's lessons at the end of every show. It's all quite sweet. It's aimed towards a younger audience. But the network are putting pressure on Vincent and the team. His partner on the team is Lenny, played by the great Dan Fogler, to keep up with the cool kids, as you say, to incorporate beatboxing and have some sort of hip-hop in there. But he just won't have it.
Get the dimes, man.
Yeah, the idea that he will put in there for some strange reason is actually an idea developed by his son. When, after his son goes missing, he becomes convinced that if he can take the drawings that his son designed of a monster, a walk-around monster, which is a more difficult puppet to make.
He's a 7-foot furry. who looks like Sully from Monsters, Inc.
Yes.
If Sully had tusks.
Yeah, and stripe and a kind of a zigzag down his back.
But that's what he's 7 foot tall. Yeah. And he's voiced by Benedict Cumberbatch with his great, gravelly. Yeah, yeah. Like almost like the dragon he did.
We see that in the Cumberbatch character, even at home, he's always doing voices. And, you know.
But it's interesting that when his son is trying to draw his attention to this puppet all along, and the son is very creative.
Yeah.
He's a sensitive boy, but he's creative. Mm. And instead of saying to him, well, let's have a look at this puppet, they're sitting at the dinner table, and he goes, well, pitch the idea to me. This is a sensitive boy.
Yeah.
He's like, pitch it to me. And of course, the kid being a kid, he stumbles slightly.
Slow.
And make an eye contact with him. Make eye contact. You know, blah, 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 blah. And it's just so, he's just so hostile to this little boy.
Yeah. So he's hardly surprising that the little boy, well, we don't know whether the boy has run off or what has happened.
No,
to him.
Nobody knows exactly what happened to him.
But there are all sorts of red herrings. I've only seen episode one. I mean, you see him coming in the day after the disappearance of just after the disappearance of the young boy, and he's got a cut in his head. Benedict, and you go, what's that cut in your head? Oh, I don't know. And you think, oh, that means something.
Yeah.
And even then, there's a scene of him quite early on at a press conference saying, tell these people that you aren't dead. And you're thinking, well, nobody said that he was dead. So there are all of these kind of red herrings, and there are lots of potential suspects around the place. Is his wife Cassie being faithful to him is a question that we've been asked about. Should she stay with such a controlling, manipulative man is another question that we were constantly asked. So there are lots of things put up in front of us here. However, things are going a little bit awry when Cassie, played by, who's the character?
Gabby Hoffman,
yeah. Cassie discovers Vinny is playing around with the son's drawings of this particular puppet, and hasn't been telling the truth to those who are investigating the disappearance of the son. Have a listen to this little bit of language, I think just towards the end of it, but you can feel the tension between husband and wife.
What are you doing with his drawings?
I told you, I'm working on a new puppet. Look, if I can get Eric on the show, then Edgar will see him. And then he'll know how much we love him, how much we want him to come home. He'll know what to do.
Oh my God. You're going crazy.
What?
You should have told them that you went after him. You should have told the police.
She's on to you, Vincent.
How did you get that cut on your forehead? Vincent, how did you get that cut on your forehead?
There you go. That is Benedict Cumberbatch. And we heard just in the midst of that, she's on to you. And that's the puppet speaking to him. Because the puppet is at the end of...
He can see that. Now, this gets cloudy.
It seems a little bit like it goes into a supernatural place at this point.
A little bit.
Or certainly off kilter.
You know, there was a TV show, I think it was called Happy, about when the guys from Law and Order, the main actor, they had that where it was basically this little unicorn that told him, and basically was his subconscious going around.
Yeah.
This is kind of not quite his subconscious, but it does make him unreliable because he can see this monster and really can't miss it. Like I said, it's 7 foot tall and a huge, big hairy. But nobody else does. So, you know, and in the opening, in the opening moments when the monster's there, like, you know, he'll say directly to the monster, shut up. And people were like, excuse me? And you know.
Cumberbatch is perfect for this in that, he can do this kind of psychopath, horrible person that you think, there's a bit of decency in there somewhere. He can evoke sympathy despite the horribleness.
Yeah, I think you need to look very, very deeply into the character he's playing to find that decency.
I'm just softer than both of you.
But he is very good at playing these troubled, tortured, volatile characters. And he is very good at playing characters that are, you know, difficult to like and impossible to root for. But as you say, you kind of hang in because you think there has to be some sort of goodness here.
Gabby Hoffman's Hudson's great with a kid. Yeah, she's perfect foil for him. She's really, really good. Yeah. And she is just as, like, honestly, when the two of them are on screen, the intensity between them burns. Yeah. She's really, really good as well. Like, she's well matched against him.
I think the big thing is, like, because this might confuse listeners, we are talking about a show, we are talking about a story about a missing child and the police investigation into it, and also this kind of exploration of 1980s New York and police institutional racism and homophobia in the NYPD. There's an awful lot going on there, but we are also talking about a show where a puppeteer believes that he's being followed around by a 7-foot blue monster. And I think that was part of the problem for me, that it's a show that takes itself very, very seriously, and it is intentionally gritty and grubby and grimy and all the rest of it, but I felt as though that fantastical magical element that just pulled me out of that reality, it pulled me out of the drama, so I found that element of a little bit too jarring. Unfortunately,
I say to you, Supernatural, that's not quite a fantastical and magical is a better way of putting the presence of the puppet there. So stars from you on this one, Chris?
I think for the performances, for the writing, and also for the setting, it was filmed in Budapest and they actually managed to turn it into a very realistic looking version of 1980s New York. All of that works very well. Cumberbatch and Gabby Hoffman work brilliantly. I just think the worst thing about Eric is actually Eric, but there is something good there for now. So for three stars for now.
And what are you saying, Arlene?
I gave it 4 out of 5. I quite like Eric because I think Eric adds. I like the look of him, and I also like the uncertain narrative that he adds to the whole flair.
All right. And what did you say? It was 4.
Four, please. I said it was very entertaining.
Fairly solid 4. That's, that is, Eric is the name of the piece. I'm trying to see on my page. I'll come to the end where and when it's on. Tomorrow on Netflix. Let us move on to number 2 then this evening, which is Camden. Disney's ambitious documentary series charts the famous London borough's impact on the music scene, exploring the influence it had on many artists that lived there. And as I started watching this, I thought, Dua Lipa is going to bring us through Camden and her connection to Camden. I just loved her particular connection to Camden. And then she goes to older artists who can, I suppose, tell the story of the Camden that she grew up in.
Yeah, I think if you look at this series as a sort of, a backstory for Dua Lipa, and she's just released a new album and she's going on tour. If you look at it as a chance for Dua Lipa to show you all about her background, where she lived when, she and her parents moved over from Kosovo, where she kind of set herself up before, when she was a YouTube artist, where she started collaborating with various DJs, that works very well. And she brings us around, the areas where she used to buy her clothes and where she used to buy records. All of that's very, very good. But it's supposed to be a series that delves into the history of Camden Town, that delves into why this became, a hotbed of creativity, why so
Mega
many
for misfits.
Exactly, yeah, as Carol Barat says at one stage, why so many musicians were drawn to this area. And it never really does that. It just kind of skips from one artist to the next. It goes on to Chris Martin and Coldplay because of the gigs they used to play in Dublin Castle. It shows us
the history in the
Dublin Castle pub run by the famous Peggy Conlon, who still runs the place at 85. It just keeps on going from artist to artist, and the stories and anecdotes, they are quite entertaining, but I just wanted it to just stop and actually give us a history of Camden Town, to actually bring us back to punk rock, bring us back to the beginning. And I don't know whether that's too much to ask from a Disney series, but there are elements of it there, because the stuff with Suggs is very good.
Yeah, less of a listen to Suggs, actually. I really loved his
great.
He tells this great thing about everybody that was here, kind of they fell out of life type of thing, and they fell out in the clothes that they were wearing. So somebody, there was an undertaker and he was called the Shroud, so the nicknames were great. There was a little section there, but then he heads into the Irishness of Camden, as we here in this clip.
Coming in here, you could have been in Cork, or it was just full of Irish people, and the whole vibe was Irish, and there'd be music going on every night. They did like a drink, they did like music, they did like dancing, and they did like laughing and romance and poetry. So all these things were completely intertwined.
The Irish community had their Irish bands every weekend, but the demographics were changing in town. So my dad thought, it's getting quieter and quieter, and I have to shake it up a bit. So these 17 and 18 year olds came in looking for a gig.
Now, what did you want?
We're in a group and we'd like to play it.
We trawled all around Camden trying to find a gig, and this pub was just slightly off the main drag, so it was just sort of a last chance.
And what sort of music?
And we thought, we'll say country and western, because it's probably going to go down better with an Irish crowd. And then I think Woody at the back helpfully chipped in with, and a bit of jazz.
We do a bit of everything, really. We do a bit of this, a bit of jazz.
And I better ask you now, what do you call yourselves?
Meds.
Madness.
That's the voice of Peggy Connellan, the landlady of the Dublin Castle. And that's a kind of a flashback sequence.
Yes.
Because they've some great material from back in the day. I don't know, what period would that have been? I suppose the 80s, 90s? Even earlier.
That was 70s, earlier, right? I think.
Yeah,
that was, 70s before that was late 70s.
Really hit
yeah.
it, I guess, yeah.
Yeah, no, they did. And they had, you know, they in the series, they go back to the Clash and they're talking about, like, they had a small soundstage at the back of the pub. And I think everyone played there. I mean, Amy Winehouse playing there. Yeah. And everybody that was anybody probably played there, you know, at one point. Because as we learned through the series, you know, people went from like a room that might hold 10 or 15 people. And then they'd go to, if they got a little bit more famous, they'd go to a room that might hold 50 if they were lucky.
Yeah.
You know, 25% of those would be their friends and family. And that's what they did. But that's how they got bigger and bigger and bigger. It wasn't sort of like modern day, you know, where you got onto TikTok and you put your songs out. This was hardcore, going, gigging around.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, and I think it was, isn't it Chris Martin of Coldplay that talks about the idea that, you know, there were 9 or 10 places. If you could go to a place and say, I can bring an audience of 15 or 20 with me, then you will, they'll buy a few drinks and that'll yeah. kind of pay the way.
And that story is so strange when you stand it up next to Dua Lipa talking about, you know, collaborating with DJs in their living room. It just seems like it's from a completely different series. Like, they're both, you know, respectable ways yeah. to kind of come up, but they just don't really sit well together. Although I should say, like, as I said at the top, I think the best thing about this series is some of the anecdotes and some of the memories, like the stuff about Coldplay playing gigs for rooms full of A&R men and an A&R man sitting down for the cameras and having a drink, and he used to work for EMI, and talking about the time that he passed up on Coldplay because he didn't think they had any hits, and then a year later he was on holidays in France with his wife and he had to pull over to the side of the road when Yellow came on because he realized that, you know, that they could have made him a fortune.
Or the Libertines, when they realized that the A&R guys were coming down to the studio, and so they rang around every single person they knew in their friends, go, look, I know I owe you a tenner, but I'll give you the tenner back if you come back to this gig and make it look like you're fans and go wild when we're on the stage. And this guy comes out and he's like, oh my gosh, they're very popular, aren't they?
Yeah. And I only saw a little bit of the first episode, but I did think the Dua Lipa backstory was quite interesting. You see her parents, very handsome couple, it has to be
ridiculously
said,
handsome,
the pair of them on their deck chairs, and coming from Kosovo at the time of the war, of course, and moving here, and her growing up, and even as a young child she was singing in the flat they were living in, you know. Her story was interesting, but is it too disparate? You kind of, I think Chris was half suggesting does it get separated in some way?
Hers is really the only one that comes from a place of like, well, this is where I grew up. I
mean, yeah. Everybody else just is came like, this, there it from just, wherever.
Well, it's bang. We're
like
in
the
Camden. Yeah, the Gallaghers. Well, there's a very small anecdote of you know, how Noel Gallagher, where he kind of rocks up and how he came there and what place of London he ended up in first. And people were just horrified that he was there and he wasn't in Camden. And then eventually comes to Camden. He's like, oh, now this, I can stumble home from here, right from the pub, right to my flat. That's great. And there's a whole host of kind of the behind the scenes story, you know, like, for example, like Liam Gallagher trying to get, you know, talk to the Clash and being ignored by them, and the Libertines then trying to get Liam Gallagher back to their flat, and he's just saying to him, no man, I don't do that, I'm more the devil's dick, and they're like, we don't know what that means, but it's awesome. So anecdotally there's loads of great stories
I'm hearing you both of you saying these are great stories,
they
but
are.
Both of you have big butts. What's your butt on stars?
There's just
Chris?
No real depth if you're looking for a meaningful, insightful portrait of Camden Town, and as I said, how it became as famous as it did, you're not going to get it. You're going to get little bits, you know, you're going to get stop start moments from a much better series. Give Soaks from Madness a series where he goes off and tells you all about the history of Dublin Castle. Give Dua Lipa an hour to tell you better proper family and musical history, and give the Libertines now another hour to talk about how they came up and how they fell apart. As it stands, all we're getting is just highlight reels,
snippets,
and teasers and trailers from far better
and
series.
And it's light.
Very light.
I mean,
very light.
There's Amy Winehouse going to the. Yeah. She went to the Dublin Castle, and there's a great story where she's being interviewed after a gig, and she said, I don't think I'll ever live here. And like, that was, that hit me very hard, because she was 27 when she died in Camden.
Yeah.
She never left. And so I think they missed kind of a little chance to delve deeper.
That's what your butts are. Great stories, but give it a bit of context and depth. Stars on this one, briefly.
3 out of 5.
3. And Chris?
Wasted opportunity, 2 out of 5.
Chris, wasted opportunity, 2 out of 5. That's Chris Wasser and Arlene Hunt. Two series that we've been speaking about. Eric, starring Benedict Cumberbatch, will be out tomorrow on Netflix. And all 4 episodes of the documentary series Camden are available to stream on Disney Plus as of today. This evening we heard the sad news that the Irish poet and writer Gerald Daw has died. He was born in Belfast in 1952 and had published 10 collections of poetry with the Gallery Press, 4 volumes of essays, as well as editing various anthologies of poetry and literary criticism. He was Professor of English and Fellow of Trinity College Dublin until his retirement in 2017. His awards include Arts Council of Ireland Poetry Awards and the Macaulay Fellowship in Literature. Last October, he joined us here on Arena to discuss his latest books of poems, a book of poems which is called Another Time. And he read one of them for us and he introduced it to us himself.
It's a poem which kind of compares two different things. Our world today and the world that I inhabited back in the 70s and 80s, going back and forward to Ballina, where my wife and her family are from, and often going there at Christmas time.
Yeah.
And we'd stop, if we were on the train, you'd stop at the wonderfully named Manulla Junction. That's on the train to Westport. So anyway, my brother-in-law passed away last year and I was thinking about him and the world that he inhabited in Mayo and Ballina, and I wrote this poem in tribute to him. It's called Level Crossings, Michael Melvin, 1937-2022. Dodging between Deliveroo, Just Eat, Amazon Prime. Is it any wonder the cyclist heads against the traffic flow? Or is it really something else entirely that's going on, post-lockdown, in the Putin mire, as the morning sun encompasses our singular undaunted tree, the old stone walls consoling mortar, the curtains billowing out like a cloud? I bet someone's nodding off under the family clock, and before I know it, I'm on my way via Manulla Junction, through bogland, sparkling lake, gorse, isolated farm, all suddenly lit up, on and on and on, to the terminus of the long ago. Train hoots approaching level crossings. The rocking carriage full of folk heading back home.
Gerald Daw there reading his poem Level Crossings from his final book of poems, Another Time. Crossing level crossings and people making their way to the terminus, making their way back home. And that is Gerald Daw in a statement this evening. Poetry Ireland says that Gerald Daw's energy and clear thinking was admired by all and that he was funny, warm and brilliant in every way. As I said, heading into that poem, his death was announced earlier today. Delighted to be joined on the phone now by Gerald's great friend and fellow poet, Iggy McGovern. And I know, Iggy, it was quite a shock for you today when the news came through. But not long back, you're not long back, in fact, from the US, where you accepted the Lawrence O'Shaughnessy Prize on Gerald's behalf. You made that journey for your friend at his behest, I'm guessing.
That's correct. And I was proud to do it, delighted to do it.
And when
I would have been happier if he was doing it himself, but that was not possible.
Not to be. And when I remember him reading that poem for me, Level Crossings, on the programme, not that long ago, in fact, I think within the last year, certainly October of last year. It's amazing how suddenly these poems mean something new in the new context of Gerald's own passing. What was the nature of your friendship with him, Iggy? How did it start?
Of the friendship?
Yeah.
Well, I was aware of him when I was at the University of Ulster in Coleraine when he was an undergraduate, but I wasn't in his company, so to speak. I was not poetry was not my thing then, but I caught up with him in Trinity College. He arrived there some years after me, and at that point I was ready to be interested in poetry, and he was very kind to me and very helpful, and it would have been one of those northern poets that I was particularly interested in. He was one of the four that would guide my path, if you like.
Yeah, so there was a kind of guiding mentorship type of relationship in some ways between the two of you.
Yeah, Absolutely, and I think it stayed that way as well. But, you know, in the sense that I was still being guided. So, but he was generous with his time.
How would you characterise his work, Iggy?
Well, I think of his work as very readable. Of course, all poems should be readable, but you didn't have to sort of search around too much for meanings and that. They were just sort of saying that, well, you know, that you could start and read through and say, right, I'm nearly there, and read through maybe another time and two, and then you're there. And they were about things that were, you know, that we all care about. About family, about politics, about problems, if you like, in the world. So, I mean, to me, he was the poet that we should go to. Yeah.
And you mentioned, you know, that it was when he was in Trinity that was part of the time when you yourself started to move towards poetry, and that he was an important guide in that process itself. What about the Belfast that Gerald Daw was from and loved? How did the city that he came from, and the particular part history of that city that was very much a part of him, how do you think that infected and influenced his own poetry?
Oh, I think so, and the most outstanding example of that is the poem "The Clock on a Wall" of Farrington Gardens, August 1971. 1971 was a pretty bad year in Belfast. He was from Ardoyne, I believe, himself. You know, and the things were pretty. I think probably for where he came from, the troubles were an enormous shock, as they were to most, I suppose. But he on this TV program, the impression I got from him that they had a wonderful sort of existence, and then suddenly everything was blown apart. Yeah. And that certainly that comes across in that poem very strongly.
And also my memory of him in studio on the several occasions when I did speak to him was he still had that great Belfast raconteur within him. He was a great teller of a story, whether in poetry or prose.
And indeed, that's true, and an extraordinary company as well.
You're going to finish, Iggy, by reading a poem of Gerald's for us, the poem Snap. Why have you chosen this one?
Well, in the sense it was chosen for me, and that Dorothea, his wife, asked me when I was agreed to go to Minnesota that I would maybe read this poem. It was a favourite of Jerry's, and I was going to do that, but the people who were running the show there, they were going to read that one instead. So I didn't get to read it now. So, but it is it's a pleasure to read it now.
Well, maybe you would finish by doing so for us, Iggy McGovern, with Gerald Daw's poem, Snap.
Snap. It says, immigrant family leaving Derry, 1930s. If I had known, I would have kept this picture on the mantelpiece of each home we had. The two of them could hardly stand still, her shy as anything, and the young lad held fast to his daddy's hand. Our tickets were in the other. The day was cool enough, a mist settled, and the engines churned and churned. It felt as if we were on the land, and the land on either side was distant, foreign. I couldn't believe we were going. The kids looked this way and that until the open sea, nothing but the sea, and I thought my heart would break.
Iggy McGovern reading Gerald Daw's poem Snap, and the death of Gerald Daw was announced today. Ar Yeshlov J. Goro Annam. Somehow that felt apt coming off the back of that poem, Snap, of Gerard Dawes, read first by Egan McGovern. Because with me in studio are Dermot Dunn and Martin Turish. The piece that you just heard, of course, a little section from the aria of Johann Sebastian Bach's Goldberg Variations, the set of variations he composed in 1741. In the space of an hour, he, I suppose, tells us and shows us and gives us to listen to everything you need to know about Western classical music. Originally written for the harpsichord, become one of the most famous pieces of music in the Western classical canon, not least because of the seminal recordings made by a young Canadian pianist, Glenn Gould, in the 1950s, responsible in no small way for lots of the modern interest in the Goldberg Variations. They've been played on all kinds of instruments, all kinds of ensembles. I've even heard mention of a didgeridoo, I think, from Dermot Dunn, who's sitting in front of me this evening. But Dermot and Martin, as you've just heard, are going to play the Goldberg Variations on two accordions. Not one, but two accordions, Dermot Dunn. Why two accordions?
Oh, because I could never manage it on one by myself. So, well, I think there's something really great about playing this music with two people together, because you have these incredible polyphonic lines where we're playing similar things but not at the same time. And when two people do it, there's a certain dialogue which opens up in the music, and it's just great, you know.
And I guess the truth of the matter is, if you were Glenn Gould, or if you were many pianists or keyboard players of any kind, you would be playing two lines maybe, or three lines on your, with the left hand, of your three tunes, if you like,
yes,
and one or two parts or voices on the right hand as well. This dividing it up like that, I guess it means, like, you were playing essentially the bass line within what we just listened to there, Martin. You're hearing that, I suppose, in a much fuller way than if you were trying to concentrate on the beautiful melody above it at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the interesting facts about the Goldberg Variations is that everybody thinks that it is that beautiful melody is what all the variations are on, but it's actually the bass line. So it's what it allows, really, is it allows for me, it's greater clarity in each of the parts, because every line Bach wrote, I mean, if you're listening to a chorale, the alto part will be absolutely stunningly beautiful as a melody on its own.
Yeah.
And it's the same with the Goldberg Variations. He just didn't write any bad lines at all. They're all exquisitely beautiful. And to be able to just pick one and concentrate on it. And for instance, with the canons as well, I particularly love those.
Go ahead.
You have the same tune coming back at you a bar later.
Frère Jacques
is a very famous one. And Bach, of course, ups the level just a little. Yeah. He's got some of the tunes coming backwards, you know. And with that bit of spatial element, you know, of Dermot sitting there and myself over here, you get to hear those much more distinctly than were coming from one instrument. So it's just a different experience of the piece. And the Goldbergs is one of those. I mean, it just keeps revealing new aspects of itself.
Yeah.
On piano, harpsichord,
or whatever instrument it happens to be. And I guess it is interesting, Dermot. I don't know how common what Bach did was in this respect. As Martin pointed out, you know, a theme and a set of variations would usually be, you'd hear that aria, then you'd hear that aria played a little faster, or you'd hear that aria played in the minor key, or you'd hear it pitched up or down maybe a note or two, or little ornaments added into it, but the aria would be permanently present. Yeah. He kind of moves away from it.
Yeah, it would be very hard to find any trace of the aria when you go through. I'm sure some musicologists have found traces, but
PhD's written
on
it, I'm sure.
The bass line, which is the connecting thing. But then he just goes on this epic journey through so many different styles, and they're all dance rhythms. All baroque music essentially comes from dance rhythms. They're not dances we know today, but you know, whether it's Irish traditional dances or Strictly Come Dancing or 17th century baroque dances, it's all about rhythm and pulse.
So you'd have the gigue, for example, in a baroque suite, and a jig is the nearest we would have to something like that. And there are lots of that's a jig within it, and so therefore, and you can hear the jig. And I guess, Martin, I was thinking of you and your background, perhaps more in that certainly traditional side of things as well. Do you see the traditional music? Can you hear it within Bach? Obviously, it's kind of upped into a kind of a more courtly type of style, but the folk origins are still there.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, yeah, that's where they come from, is folk dances. And you can hear that, but there's been more of a movement recently as well with players sort of putting more of a folk musician's emphasis on it. You see it at the proms recently, and you start seeing more and more of it, because any gal where you don't play each note exactly the same is a part of the music as well. And that's such a big thing for us in trad. And it brings a completely different mention or element to the music. Yeah. Because a lot of the rhythms, you do find them in reels. When we first started this, Dermot said, Martin, you should look at this. There's a load of jigs in here and some that are like reels. It'll be right up your street.
Is number 14 a reel or a jig?
It'll be quite similar to a reel.
Let's have a listen to this is variation number 14. You'll hear none of the aria in here because it's certainly a lot faster.
It is.
Not quite the same speed as the aria, it has to be said.
Much closer to a reel.
Yeah, variation number 14 of the Goldberg variation, played on two accordions there, Martin Turish and Dermot Dunn. And actually, you know, in some ways, there's a difficulty, and it really involves a lot of communication between the two of you, because what people couldn't see there was just how you literally, one little, you'd go do-do-do, and Martin would go do-do-do. Almost as a response to it.
Oh, it's really is a ping pong variation. Yeah. I call it. It's like a game of really fast table tennis. Yeah, it took a while to get that.
A lot of
practice. Yeah, I'd say.
But the sequences in this music, there's so many sequences in Bach, and the patterns repeat downwards, and it's just, it's a beauty. It's difficult.
All right, well, we are going to finish up with 29, but let us just at variation number 29, which I hope is equally difficult for both of you.
It is.
The concert itself is on the 5th, which I'll give people the full details
the 6th,
of. Sorry, beg your pardon.
Thursday
the 6th.
Thursday next week.
Thursday of next week. That's the date of the concert, but there's a little pop-up happening before it.
Yeah, so the concert is part of the Dublin International Chamber
Music
Festival.
Yeah, I'll give all the details, sure. Don't worry about that.
And on next Tuesday, which is, I think, the 4th, at 11 a.m., free event, a little pop-up performance in the chapel in Trinity College. So it's free, but you can reserve tickets on Eventbrite, and we'll do a little selection. We're not going to do the whole thing then.
And there'll be a historian speaking there about the casino, which is where you're performing.
Yeah, the
on
casino
the night of the
Marino,
concert.
And William Chambers, who designed the casino and the Pugh Lane Gallery and the Customs House. I think a lot of big important buildings in Dublin.
We'll be talking about those as well as hearing a few of the variations. So, what do I need to know about number 29? What dance am I dancing here? What would be closest to?
It's a difficult one, whatever the case may be. It's in triple meter, and a It's right at the end of the piece, pretty much.
We've got a very fast waltz.
So it's as festive as you get.
Ready?
It is as much a visual treat as it is an oral treat, I can tell you. You should see Dermot Dunn and Martin Turish communicate to each other visually as they're playing those pieces. Absolutely stunning there, the variation number 29 of Johann Sebastian Bach's Goldberg Variations for two accordions, arranged by Dermot Dunn, played by Dermot Dunn and Martin Turish. And there will be two performances on the Thursday, the 6th of June at the Casino in Marino, and the 2024 International Chamber Music Festival runs from the 4th to the 9th of June. Other events include the Dublin premiere of Deirdre Gribben's Strawberry Moon, pianist Hugh Tinney and cellist Adrian Brendel, violinist Catherine Hunke and clarinetist Carol McGonnell playing Brahms, Beethoven and Schubert. DICMF.com, and don't forget that pop-up in Trinity on the 4th. Dermot, Martin, thanks very much for coming.
Thanks a million. Thanks, Sean.
For many of us, Ulysses has been the mainstay of Irish contemporary literature, released in our published in 1922. It's James Joyce's modernist parallel to Homer's Odyssey, and the action of Ulysses takes place on a single day in Dublin and its surrounding areas on Bloomsday, June the 16th. There are three protagonists, I suppose, intended to be modern counterparts of Telemachus, Ulysses, that's Odysseus, and Penelope, respectively. And the events of the novel loosely parallel those major events of Odysseus's journey home after the Trojan Wars. The Molly films is a modern retelling of the Penelope episode, episode 18 of the Joycean novel. The Molly films are eight newly commissioned short films with eight actors each performing a reading of one of eight sections from the final episode, Penelope, of James Joyce's Ulysses. Five films have been recorded and will be premiered at the Yes Festival, performed by Dame Harriet Walter, Siobhan McSweeney, Adoja Ando, Eve Hewson and Fiona Shaw. Quite a cast lineup that. But I'm joined this evening on the phone by the director and cinematographer of the films, Sophie Musochenko. Very happy for you to be with us on Arena this evening, Sophie. It's a big question as to who Molly Bloom is, but who is Molly for you?
Hello, everybody. It's a pleasure to talk to you about it. Well, Molly is incredible, outstanding woman, absolutely liberated for her time. And I think one of the most significant female characters in the history of literature.
And what you have done, what you've done in this, is that you've taken this one character and essentially taken each of the very long, unpunctuated sentences of the Joycean episode, as it were, and given us these five films. So have we five different versions of Molly, five different aspects of Molly? What is that for you?
Yes. So the whole episode contain eight sentences, and each sentence is one actress. And we were trying in the very first place to unify it and find the similarities between these all of these actors. But I found it much more interesting to actually underline their differences, the different backgrounds, the different age, and shoot it in a different ways. Especially, as you said, it's quite a long piece, even that it's one episode. So we decided to divide it and give each of the actors different visual storytelling idea. So, for example, Fiona's one, we're having black and white.
Yeah.
And with Siobhan McSweeney, we have American Night.
There you go. Very interesting. And Eve Hewson has a kind of a lovely, golden, luscious feel off it in what she's doing. But you mentioned the Fiona Shaw one, and I saw a little section of the Fiona Shaw piece today. And I must say, the way she speaks almost directly to the camera, downright looking right at us and telling us Molly's story, is very interesting indeed. Let's have a little listen to a little bit of her sentence then, which is the very first in the episode, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Either she leaves or me leaves. Either she or me leaves the house. I couldn't even touch him if I thought he was with a dirty barefaced liar and sloven like that, one denying it up to my face and singing about the place in the WC2 because she knew she would. Oh, she was too well off. Oh, yes, because he couldn't possibly do without it that long, and so he must do it somewhere. And the last time he came on my bottom, I just pressed the back of his like that with my thumb to squeeze back, singing, "The young May Moon, she's beaming love," because he has an idea about him and me. He's not such a fool. He said, "I'm dining out and going to the Gaiety, though. I'm not going to give him the satisfaction in any case. God knows. He's a change in a way."
Wonderful Fiona Shaw there in one of the Molly films that cinematographer and director Sophie Musochenko is talking to me about this evening. She really brings the character so much to life. And for large parts of this, she's prone on a bed, kind of looking out of us, and you think there's no energy within that. But you create a type of visual energy in what you've done with the cinematography here, Sophie.
Yes, I think that was one of the hardest part to keep the attention, audience's attention on screen, especially Fiona's sentence, it goes for 22 minutes. And originally in the novel, you don't have a lot of action. Most of all of the movement going on in her head. And we decided just to keep it small, intimate, and so everybody can relate to this piece. As doesn't matter, are you in your 70s, are you Molly's age in her 30s, or you're my age and you're a bit younger.
Yeah, so I suppose that's what the different performances give us. They give us different aspects of the character of Molly. I mean, I'm sure Siobhan McSweeney brings a great comedic sensibility to what she's doing.
Yeah, absolutely. That was, I mean, her sentence was the longest one. We were going for half an hour. And we were going for, with her, actually, with her sentence, it was her as a narrator. And we see her as a double exposure in a door frame, and this just a physical movement, Molly, just moving back and forth. Because for me, as a director in this piece, was really important to find the way to give it to the audience such a blended experience. Because usually, then you see the monologue and. I mean, it is a monologue of Molly. If you see it on stage, you have the actor talking to the audience directly, but you can't do it in film. And I was trying to find a way how to merge this line between cinema and theatre, where you can experience that in the most relatable way.
Right. Finally, and briefly, if you could, Sophie, I know that you're originally from Ukraine and you're living in these parts of the world now for obvious reasons, but the cinematographer, the director of photography, Seamus McGarvey, was very instrumental in getting you out of Ukraine and starting things up for you here, I think.
Yes, that's true. Seamus McGarvey is my sponsor in UK, and then the full invasion of war started. I was in Kyiv, and I was preparing music video for that point. And then I had to leave to Poland, where I reached out to Seamus, and he kindly offered me to come to his house in Tuscany, and then brought me to UK and introduced me to one of the biggest names like Joe Wright, Lynn Ramsey, Robbie Ryan.
And here you are.
Such
now.
Amazing.
And here you are now with these Molly films. Thanks so much for being with us this evening, Sophie, and for giving us of your time. Sophie Musachenko there, director and cinematographer of the Molly films. You can see them in their entirety at their premiere during the Yes Festival. They will be screened at the Yes Hub in St. Columb's Hall in Derry across the festival from the 13th through until the 16th of June. Full details found on the website yesderry.com. And that is our lot for this Wednesday evening. Niall Fitzmaurice and Liam Murphy researched. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Cara O'Hare was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RTÉ Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.